Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, July 23rd, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time and from 10 to 11 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are archived on drsaputo.com and prn.fm.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And we've got an amazing show for you today that's going to include the importance of the doctor-patient relationship.
And bringing transparency to Big Pharma.
And how much vitamin C do you really need?
And is surgery the best treatment for localized prostate cancer?
And much, much more.
And if you would like to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call on Mondays from 10 to 11 a.m. Pacific Time or 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Remember the old movies about the roles of doctors in the westerns, like Dr. Welby and Dr. Kildare and the rest of them?
All the real doctors, huh?
Yeah, and the image that they really cared and that they would make home visits to help you out. You know, medicine now has become so high-tech, and everybody's complaining about how their doctors are in a hurry, and they're just, like, moving them in and moving them out. So tell us about this $6 million grant to test the comprehensive care physicians model.
This is almost annoying. You know, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation has given a $6 million grant to the University of Chicago to do what? To go back and see if the old-time way of treating patients and evaluating patients was better than the new way of HMO medicine where we have just a little bit of time. You know, when Vicki mentioned about Dr. Kildare and Dr. Welby, I mean, these were people who were like family almost. You were connected. They were listening. They cared. They'd make a house call.
They were so likable.
Really? Yeah. And you might pay them with whatever you could afford. It might be a chicken, or it might be a dinner,
or a pie.
could be anything. And today, I don't think it's the same, and I don't think we need a grant for $6 million to go back and prove it, but they're going to do it anyway. We have to find ways to treat people and meet them where they are, and we need to look at all aspects of who they are. We don't want to just treat them with technology, with things like antibiotics and digitalis and some of the medicines we use or some of the technologies that lead to surgeries. We don't want to just lead to that.
One of the things that I think is really good that they're finding is that providing better care at a lower cost, they're providing better care at a lower cost by strengthening the bond and the continuity between the doctor and the patient.
Yeah, what a concept, huh?
Yeah, because look at what's happened, you know, like with the hospitalist, for example. Let's talk about what a hospitalist is and how that's so different from the old way of having the doctor come in, the patient's own doctor coming and see them in the hospital.
Yeah, well, see, that's the way I did it when I was in practice for the most part back in the, I mean, up until about 1995 or 1996, maybe even through the early 2000s. I mean, I had a busy inpatient practice, meaning lots of people who I had in the hospital. I probably averaged five or six. I worked in the ICU and the CCU, and I led the way. It was me that was continuing the relationship I had with my patients from the office. And if I needed to pull in people like a neurologist or a nephrologist or somebody who was a cardiologist, no problem. I supervised all that. And basically, I made the decisions with the patient in consultation with these experts who my patients didn't know very well at the start and couldn't really have a lot of confidence in. That was beautiful medicine because it included them in what we decided to do.
But now what happens is you go to the hospital and you don't see your own doctor.
They hardly ever go.
They don't make rounds like they used to do.
So the hospitalist now is a specialist. That person works just in the hospital and takes care of people when they have these acute problems. And there's some advantage to that technologically. I mean, you'd definitely like to have somebody who's on top of their game when it comes to knowing all the latest things you need to do for somebody who has a serious healthcare problem, might even be dying in the ICU or the CCU.
But when somebody's not dying or you know, deathly ill or seriously ill in the hospital, doctors, for the most part, have closed minds about alternatives.
Well, that too.
Because you're definitely one of the exceptions to the rule.
Well, that's one of the limitations. I think what I'm trying to point out here with the hospitalists is that they're really good at dealing with what they do. Yes, Vicki, you're right. They have limited knowledge in other fields.
And they also can't be as personal with the patient and the family as the patient's own family doctor.
No, because they don't know them, and they tend to get more oriented just in the technology. When somebody's really sick, it needs a team of people led by the primary care physician, the family, the patient, somebody who's concerned with rehabilitation, maybe somebody who is looking at the spiritual aspects of what's happening, especially if somebody's near death. All these things are important to manage, and they should be supervised in a way where the patient, when they're alert and capable, should be the center focus of attention. Lots of listening, lots of caring, lots of technology if it's needed. But
you know,
we need all those things.
And yeah, you know, probably everybody has their stories. I mean, I have a couple of stories. One of them is when you were in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a good rapport, we saw it, with your doctor. And you weren't doing so well. You had some complications from your surgery.
Right.
And the doctor came in, and it was on day, whatever it was, two or something. Mm-hmm. And he sat down in the chair. Didn't walk up to your bedside or anything, just came in, sat down in the chair. Well, I had a cot in the room. I was lying on the cot when he came in. It was like 8 in the morning, I guess.
Thank you for being my advocate.
And he says, okay, so you'll be going home today or tomorrow, whatever it was, and da-da-da-da-da. And I sat up and I said, he can't even get out of bed. His blood pressure keeps dropping out. He didn't even know that.
Right.
And it turned out that you ended up having to be rushed to the CCU by an ambulance and so on and so forth. But that's not the whole story there. So the main point I'm just trying to make is just the fact that the doctor was treating you just like the patient in room 462, treating you like an individual.
Well, he was more interested actually at that point in time because he hadn't paid much attention and to what was happening with me and didn't expect any complications. He was more interested in getting me in and out of the hospital as quickly as possible because it made his record look better. I can get them in and out quickly. It doesn't cost as much. We have a good result, and you need to pay attention.
So
and the problem with rounds in the morning is that very often the doctors don't spend as much time as they should. They may
have to get to the office.
Well, they got lots of things to do, right? And you may just be one of many patients, and they don't necessarily want to spend a lot of time with you. I know they spend time with the chart because I always did too. But you've got to have that personal time that's connected with that patient.
You need to treat the patient as a person, not just as a disease.
Well, yeah, and there's a very personal, important part about treating people like human beings who have a disease rather than a disease that just happens to be attached to a human being. Big difference. We also spend too much money at the end of life in hospitals, and we should be thinking more in terms of life being a cycle where there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. We expect to die. You don't expect to die with a tube in every orifice and being resuscitated necessarily if you have end-stage disease. You may want to be at home, and you need a doctor who's connected to you because it's a very personal relationship. These are huge decisions. So we need to be present when that situation is there, and we need to take an action that's a team action. So we need to be team players. I think a lot of the time, the technology is what takes over. And we wind up being involved in a situation where doctors are doing all the tests they can possibly think of. They're practicing defensively because they don't want to miss something or get sued. And the screening tests that we do tend to be overdone. And so we wind up doing way too many things. And I think that the United States Preventive Services Task Force has started to point these things out. Defensive medicine isn't the only way to deal with what's happening. It's that personal relationship. We need doctors who are open-minded, connected, interested in integrative strategies, willing to look outside of their box of what their little discipline is about and include other kinds of therapies. I can remember some patients that I had where I had to sneak professionals into the room to give them therapies. And so the kinds of therapies that we would give might be acupuncture. They might be Reiki. I know when one patient, you came in and did some Reiki.
Yeah.
We had people doing neurofeedback. All things that if the hospital staff knew that's what we were doing, I'd have been in hot water.
And the patient's family just couldn't thank us enough. They were
so
appreciative.
Well, it's because you stretch yourself, as we all, as scientists and physicians and humanitarians should do. We should be looking at how can we give the most to our patients so they can get well. Why are we stuck with just one system that looks at a particular style of practice, which, of course, is drugs, surgeries, and technologies for the most part? We need to do anything we possibly can. It's why I started the Health Medicine Forum in 1994, where we brought together practitioners of different disciplines together in an organization that would find ways to work together in a synchronized sort of way. So you wind up with acupuncturists and body workers and chiropractors and MDs and psychologists and people did Reiki, anything you could think of.
This is why I think it's such a shame that the way our healthcare system is set up, that the health insurance companies don't cover alternatives.
Well, you know, in some states, in the state of Washington, they did this years ago. I'm not sure they still do. They had a law there that was exactly on the money. It basically said that if you were licensed by the state, that insurance companies were required to reimburse for those services. That was wonderful.
What do you mean if you were licensed by the state?
You had a license to practice medicine or to do body work or to do whatever it is that you did.
So any healthcare practitioner that was licensed
would have to be reimbursed by an insurance company. And of course, there's such a turf war going on between the doctors who want to control all that
turf. And insurance companies that want to control, too.
Well.
And now that we've got all this HMO and PPO medicine and everything so controlled.
Well, that's right.
And doctors are having to practice defensive medicine and overdoing all the diagnostic tests.
Well, the problem still is that we tend to do just what's in our field, and we have this arrogant attitude that only our field is the field that makes a difference. And that doesn't just go for MDs. That goes for every field of medicine I've come across, of healthcare that I've come across. We have to remember who the healer is. The healer, of course, is the internal, the healer on the inside. And Albert Schweitzer said it very nicely when he said, the job of the physician is to put the patient in touch with the inner healer and let what happens happen, because that's where the real action is.
I know you've told me many times that patients that come to see you, that basically if you listen to them well enough and long enough, that they know pretty much what's wrong with them, and they also know pretty much how to heal themselves.
They really do. And so what we ought to be doing as doctors is making that connection between the inner healer and the patient.
Listening.
Well, listening and caring and being supportive and being open-minded about what approaches can be. You know, we even talk about things as silly as voodoo and say, oh, that's just crazy. That's just outrageous. We would never do such a thing in our hospitals. We won't allow that to happen. But look at the power of placebo, and look at the bigger power of nocebo, which is the opposite of placebo, where you actually put thoughts in people's minds. And I got to tell you, you may not call it voodoo, but when an oncologist says, I think you have 6 months to live, that's powerful. And very often, that's how long people will live.
Well, that was, too, also when I was a nurse, we were instructed not to ask a patient if they were nauseated, because all you have to do is ask them and then they get nauseated.
Well,
the power of suggestion. So make your suggestions positive.
Well, that's right. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for a short commercial break, followed by Vicki's first 2020 tip, stopping Monsanto's sneak attack. We'll be back in a flash, so stay with us.
Reported that there's A controversial rider attached to the U.S. House of Representatives' 2013 agriculture appropriations bill that would make it impossible for organic and non-GMO consumers and farmers to fight Monsanto in court when the U.S. Department of Agriculture illegally approves new genetically engineered crops that could eliminate a farmer's choice to grow non-genetically engineered crops or a consumer's choice to eat non-genetically engineered food. Now, Jack Kingston, who's a Republican from Georgia, is the congressman responsible for inserting this pro-industry provision that has nothing to do with agriculture appropriations. These biotech giants like Monsanto and DuPont, they actually named him as its legislator of the year for 2011 and 2012. And they declared Kingston a champion of America's technology industry, helping to protect funding for programs essential to the survival of biotechnology companies across the United States. Now, talk about conflicts of interest and the effects of lobbying. I mean, give me a break here.
Really?
Well, anyway, the good news is that Representative Peter DeFazio, who's a Democrat from Oregon, will sponsor an amendment to the Agriculture Appropriations Bill that could nullify Kingston's Monsanto-friendly provision. So, what you need to do is to ask, all of us need to ask our members of Congress to support the DeFazio amendment. It's pretty horrifying, you know, when you think about all this, that we have to fight our own government to save the environment. But we do, and there are many threats to our environment that are in the latest farm bill, and now the Agriculture Appropriations Bill, which contains this amendment that's been renamed the Monsanto Protection Act. The environment is worth fighting for, and the Organic Consumers Association is trying to fight Monsanto. So check them out and do a Google search and see what you can do to stop the Monsanto Protection Act that's requiring farmers to plant genetically engineered seeds, growing all genetically engineered food, taking away our right to eat organic non-GMO foods. I mean, this shows the power of money over our health and ethics, and it's just crazy. But anyway, let's get together and stop Monsanto's sneak attack.
You're right, Vicki. So right. These things that we don't take enough responsibility for lead to lots of problems that are a major issue, and so we have to stand up and stop these kinds of things. This is what Gary Null is all about. He does stand up, he does talk, and there is change, and there are lots of listeners who are who are agreeing with him completely.
The pharmaceutical industry has had the unfair advantage of doing research and concealing it from the public and from scientific scrutiny. When you think about it, this is pretty amazing. This study data shows that the studies that the pharmaceutical companies do and how they conceal all this information from us, this data is not published. It's considered private. It's confidential. So they can exaggerate it and FDA just approves it. We're expected to trust that this information is accurate. Now, the European Medicines Agency, the EMA, is doing something different. So what are they doing?
Well, this is fascinating, and it's about time that this happens. They're the equivalent of the FDA in this country. And what they've decided, finally, is that they want to open up some of the information, the research that's done by the pharmaceutical industry that has been kept secret. And that secret information, of course, keeps things cloudy for us because we never really know if their research can be trusted or not. We know the cases that we have that have come out, like of Vioxx and Avandia, that are just unbelievably horrible in how these companies think. They're actually allowed to commit legal murder is what this is about. You look at the scandal from Vioxx, and it's absolutely shocking.
Pharmacide.
It is pharmacide. I mean, in 1995, the pharmaceutical industry knew that Vioxx was going to cause heart attacks and strokes. But that didn't stop them from continuing their research because they knew they had a new class of drugs that they could convince doctors to order and patients to request. And when it came out in 1999, they didn't make any mention of the fact that there were heart attack or stroke problems associated with Vioxx. And by the year 2004, we were finding all these heart attacks and strokes, and people started to get the idea that this was something that was really wrong. So the company making Vioxx comes to the rescue, and they say, oh, well, we'll take it off the market. Well, they knew initially that there were going to be lots of deaths, and there turned out to be an estimated 50,000 deaths from that. They knew they would be sued. In fact, they will lose probably in the range of $5 billion in lawsuits.
But that's the only punishment they got.
Well, they made, well, that wasn't even much of a punishment because they made $20 billion. So that's a $15 billion difference in what happened here. So that's what I would call smart business, but terrible ethics. And that is outright murder. And you would think that somebody would have been prosecuted by the law and saying, this is murder. Because it is.
And, you know, something similar seems to be going on with Avandi, and yet that's still on the market, the diabetic drug.
That, to me, is stunning. I mean, talk to Dr. John Buse from the University of North Carolina, who's in charge of their Department of Endocrinology there, and he's been publishing information for 10 years talking about how Avandi causes more heart attacks and more people who have those heart attacks die than people who are not on it. And, of course, one of the objectives of the drugs to maintain normal blood sugar levels is to prevent heart attacks and strokes. So what we have here that's different is that the European Medicines Agency, which is the Europe's FDA, has finally come out and said that they don't think it's in the best interest of the public to keep this information confidential.
Well, they had a little bit of pressure to do that.
Well, they had a lot of pressure, but what we have here are conflicts of interest. You look at the person, a fellow named Thomas Longren, who was the executive director of the EMA. And basically, when his term was up and a new fellow came in named Guido Rossi, he's the one that's been pushing to keep all these scientific, quote, scientific studies transparent so we could review them. He, within a few weeks of being out of a job, is employed by who? He's a consultant for the pharmaceutical industry.
Of course. It's just like Julie Gerberding.
Exactly. Julie Gerberding is somebody who was the director of the CDC. And when her term was up and Obama came in, within a few weeks, she was employed by who? By Merck's Department of Vaccines. And it's estimated that if she makes what other people do from other companies in the same position, it's between $2 and $6 million a year plus stock options. So what we're looking at here is a revolving door that's full of conflicts of interest between the pharmaceutical industry, the FDA, and the CDC.
There's no ethics going on here, and money talks. I mean, just watch Gary Knowles' movie, Death by Medicine.
Exactly. What a tremendous service Gary has done for the community. And, I mean, this whole business with immunizations in particular, or vaccines in particular, is a huge step forward. When Julie Gerberding was supporting the swine flu vaccine, and all kinds of rules were being made by state legislatures to require the swine flu vaccine, our own Gary Knowles in New York passing legislation in a lawsuit, making sure that that would not happen in the state of New York. And finally, the state of New York backed down and said they would not require the swine flu vaccine for anybody. So what we have here is an interesting battle that's going on between people who want to do things that are right and people that are more interested in making money and having power. That has to stop.
And if you want to learn any more about the pharma of big pharma,
the karma
of big pharma, go to Dr. Saputo's book, A Return to Healing. And it's in a chapter in his book. I think it's chapter 5.
Yep.
But if you don't want to read his book, you can also just watch it in video on the website, Dr. Saputo, SAPUTO.com.
You know, this whole business in this book, I wrote this book that was published a couple of years ago with the idea of being really a whistleblower to explain what's going on with medical education, with medical research, with the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry, the FDA, the CDC, the World Health Organization, and show all the corruption that's there. But it doesn't stop there because it goes on to show and describe a healthcare system that we have devised out here in Northern California that's called health medicine, where what we're looking at is integrative, holistic person-centered and preventive medicine. And we practice that way now in Walnut Creek in a place called the Health Medicine Center. And of course, if you want to learn more about that, read the book, because that's got all these answers in it. And it, I think everybody who's interested in doing the right thing could look at this, because what we have is corruption across every boundary in our culture. It's not just medicine that's corrupt. It's business. It's law. It's medicine. It's religion. It's sports. It's politics. There are no places that are safe in this culture from the kinds of greed and narcissistic behavior that we have in this country. Our value system needs to change. Anyway, the lines are open now. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
Well, researchers have found that something as simple as increasing the RDA, the recommended dietary allowance of vitamin C, could help prevent heart disease, strokes, cancer, and more for just pennies a day. So how much did the scientists recommend increasing it?
Well, this is an interesting study that was done at the Linus Pauling Institute. And basically it was published in a journal called Critical Reviews in Food Science and Nutrition. And today, the RDA for vitamin C is 75 milligrams for women and 90 milligrams for men. Well, that's going to prevent scurvy, all right, but it's not going to do much to increase the antioxidant protection that we need to prevent disease. Because we need to look at what causes illness to occur. What is fueling the epidemic of chronic diseases that we have? And basically, what we're looking at is an imbalance between antioxidant protection against free radical damage. And if you don't have enough reserves of antioxidants, the free radicals, which cause premature aging, destroy tissues that they come in touch, that they come in contact with, lead to the final common pathway that causes this epidemic of chronic diseases we're seeing. So,
and
200 milligrams a day is not sufficient.
It's peanuts. We need vitamin C, but our bodies can't make it. So we need to ask the question, is diet enough? Because with the SAD, the
Standard American Diet,
people are not usually getting like 5 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. So a glass of orange juice isn't going to do it for enough vitamin C. So why are they meeting resistance with this?
Well, see, doctors are not trained in nutrition. It's just that simple. I went to Duke Medical School, and there I must have had 1 or 2 hours of nutrition, but that's all. And to me, it's almost inconceivable that something as important as supplying your body with the building blocks that it must have to be able to produce the products that it needs to make energy and to keep us in a healthy state is not something that we focus on. So when you don't know about nutrition and you're into drugs and surgeries and technologies, the arrogance is what gets in the way. You start saying, well, I'm trained at the best medical schools and they don't think nutrition is that big a deal or that it's not that important. And so you wind up in a conflict with those people who are cellular biochemists, like Linus Pauling was exceptional at. In fact, he got 2 Nobel Prizes, one for his work in cellular biochemistry and another for the Peace Prize. But apparently his work in the Peace Prize didn't have much of an impact on doctors, because we basically threw that stuff out and said, Linus, why don't you stick to your biochemistry and we doctors will stick to our treating people.
Well, you used to be that way too until about 20 years ago when I got so sick and had a life-threatening allergy and I ended up taking 90 grams, that's 90,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day for 9 months.
Yeah, now see, how much do you need? Depends on who you are, what your condition is, what your antioxidant deficiency is.
Like, you can't just go out and start taking that much vitamin C on your own.
Oh, if you did, you'd be very sorry within a matter of just a few hours.
But see, if you're sick and your body requires it and needs it, and there's ways to find out how much your body needs, then it's okay. But I remember, too, back when we were first learning about all this, and you had a patient that had shingles really bad in her eye, and she had to be admitted to the hospital, and you wanted to give her IV vitamin C, and you were going to be gone for a couple of days, and you asked your partner if he would continue on with the IV vitamin C, and he gave you a bad time, thought it was crazy, said, come on, let's not do this.
Yeah, the hospital staff will be all over you.
And you talked him into it, and when you came back, you said you saw him running down the hall to you saying, it worked, it worked.
Right. Do you think maybe somebody would get the idea to try it again for somebody else who had a problem like that?
Well, another thing is with mononucleosis, you've had patients that the vitamin C, high doses of it, have really helped them get over their mono, just like in a day even.
Well, it's a couple of days, and it's shocking. You know, I had a patient that was a cheerleader. She must have been 16 or 17 years old. This was about 15 years ago. Come in to see me, and we diagnosed mononucleosis. And that same day, I said, you know, I think I know a way to make the mono go away pretty quick, but it's unfortunately going to cause some diarrhea today. She says, you got to be kidding. Diarrhea on top of what I've already got? No, thank you. But I said, well, if you'll try it, you might find that it's really powerful. And she decided to do that. So I said, when you're done with all this, call me a couple hours later and let me know how you feel. Well, she called me at 11 that night after she had taken something like 70,000 milligrams of oral vitamin C. She got the diarrhea, but she was also up cleaning her room. She felt great. And 3 days later, she went back to school and within a week was doing her cheerleading. And that's a typical story of people who have mononucleosis, but you have to know how to regulate the dose of vitamin C to what we call bowel tolerance.
You know, vitamin C can have significant effects on public health, and it's cheap. And the research shows that it can even reduce blood pressure, inflammation, and it can boost immunity. Even if our government doesn't approve these recommended dietary daily allowances of vitamin C to go from 75 to 200 milligrams a day, the way it is right now, we could do that on our own anyway.
Well, that's right. And I also want to look at the research that's out there that you were mentioning. There was an analysis of 29 studies on humans that concluded that a daily supplement of just 500 milligrams a day would, as Vicki said, reduce systolic and diastolic blood pressure and would reduce mortality substantially. There was another study on 20,000 men and women where mortality from cardiovascular disease was 60% lower if you had a higher level than a lower level. And a third study was done that showed that men with the lowest levels of vitamin C had a 62% higher risk of cancer-related death after about 15 years. And we don't do research over 15 years very often, but that's where we are. So this business of vitamin C is a big deal and needs to be respected. All right, it's time for Vicki's 2020 tip. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888 if you have a question about your health or about what we're talking about. And we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's final 2020 tip.
It's important to clean our homes with green cleaning and avoid toxins. Often we think that we're cleaning and we're making our homes smell good, and we're really contaminating ourselves and our families with chemicals worse than the germs that we think that we're eliminating to be healthy. Now, what we surround ourselves with is important to our health, so it's important to clean our house with non-toxic natural cleaning products. One of my favorites is putting some white vinegar in a spritzer and some hydrogen peroxide in another spritzer. Spray it with one, followed by the other. Wipe it off. It'll clean fungus, bacteria, viruses. And then another thing is that baking soda, it's also a good natural cleaner and deodorizer. And you can sprinkle baking soda on the carpet and vacuum it up later, and it'll get rid of odors. You can mix a teaspoon of baking soda and just a teaspoon of lemon juice in 2 cups of hot water, put it in a spritzer, and voila. Also, leave a little open container of baking soda in the bathroom for odors.
Or put it in your refrigerator.
Yeah, put it in your refrigerator, put it under your arms.
Yeah, under your arms is terrific.
So avoid chlorine bleach, strong solvents, ammonia, antibacterial products, especially made with triclosan, because antibacterials such as triclosan can spur drug-resistant superbugs, much like antibiotics. Also, avoid synthetically fragranced candles, laundry detergents, air fresheners, and dryer sheets. Air fresheners are loaded with fragrances containing chemicals, most often the phthalates that can cause hormonal abnormalities and birth defects and reproductive problems. So if you see the word fragrance in an ingredient list, you can assume it's 100% synthetic with a lot of toxins and sensitizers, not natural flower extracts, which it sounds like. Also, remember that unscented doesn't mean no fragrances, because a lot of times they put masking fragrances to cover up the bad odors that are really in there. Now, air fresheners and aerosols can cause headaches, depression. They can cause ear infections in infants as well as diarrhea. And aerosols contain flammable and nerve-damaging ingredients like hexane and xylene. Plus, their small little mist particles enter the bloodstream when they're inhaled. So make your own potpourri with essential oils. Essential oils are not the same as fragrance oils. You have to be careful and read that in the ingredients. Essential oils come from plants, and fragrance oils are artificial, and they often contain the unhealthy synthetic chemicals. So if you feel you must use candles, try beeswax or even soy and make sure that their fragrance is made from essential oils. And remember that just because you buy something in the health food store doesn't mean that you don't need to check the ingredients. If you want your home to smell good, get at the cause and clean it up.
Right.
Dump the trash. You know, the other day I was noticing something wasn't smelling so good on our counter, and I looked around behind my fruit bowl, and there was a potato. And it had gotten rotten or something. Potato, ugh, it was terrible. So check your potatoes. Open the windows. Put out fresh flowers. Get an air purifier. Use a salt crystal lamp. You get the idea. Now, skip fabric softener and dryer sheets that contain chemicals. Instead, go without or try a half a cup of white vinegar in the rinse cycle. Stay away from dangerous oven cleaners. Instead, you can cover the bottom of the oven with baking soda and then spray it with water, and 8 hours later, scrape it and wipe it clean. And read the ingredients. Labels are often deceiving. Trust the warnings, not the marketing claims. Find the ingredients before you buy the product, on the label or under the label. Sometimes you have to peel it back and it's on the back. You can go to their website or thecleaninginstitute.org or call the maker, and avoid brands that don't tell you what they contain, because they're usually hiding something. Now, the Environmental Working Group recommends avoiding pine oil, citrus oil, something about reacting with ozone and forming cancer-causing formaldehyde, also known as limonene, orange, lime, or lemon peel or oil or extract. And anything ammonium, and some good resources are the Environmental Working Group Guide to Greener Cleaning. It's also known as EWG. And also Beth Greer has a great book called Supernatural Home. So happy cleaning, healthy cleaning.
That's a great tip, Vicki. You know, it reminds me of a commercial that's on television that comes out with an air freshening product. And what they do is they blindfold people, and they take them into a room that's obviously a dump. And there's garbage laying all over the place, and it obviously stinks, and it's miserable, and nobody wants to be in the room. But they spray this air freshener in there, and people come in, and they can't see what's there. And they say, smell this. How does it smell? And they go, oh, this smells like sea breeze. It's wonderful. Then they take the blindfold off, and, of course, they see the mess. So the message here is, yeah, you can cover up smells, but it's like the practice of medicine, we got to get to the cause rather than just treat the symptoms, because that's how problems progress. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
You know, as a man, if you're diagnosed with prostate cancer, many times the option is surgery, and most men are scared at the word cancer, and so they go ahead and they go for the surgery. But if it's a localized, slow-growing type of prostate cancer, it's only going to kill you like 3% of the time. And what's been happening is that the treatment is given to, like, all the men. So the 97% that are not going to die from this cancer.
Well, it's offered to all the men. Not all of them take them up on that. But the problem is like what you said, is if you use the word cancer, like the big C, there's such a charged word. The next thing we're thinking of is we're equating cancer to death. And while we can with a lot of cancers, with a lot of them, it's not that way at all. In fact, some of them spontaneously regress. But the problem is how do you find out who has what?
Well, the other thing is, too, I just want to bring out right now, is that many of these men that have the prostate cancer diagnosis and have the surgery end up being incontinent and impotent. So it really affects the quality of their life. And that is why this important, this topic is important to talk about.
Well, see, back in 1988 or so, Professor Thomas Stamey, a physician from Stanford, came out with a test called the PSA. And that prostate-specific antigen test is designed to pick up cancers. But the problem is about 50% of the elevated PSA values are not cancer. And so we're way over-diagnosing or way over-screening people. And of those people who have cancer, about 25% of them will have a PSA that's in the normal range. So it's hard to base it just on that. And so we've got this test that gets us into a lot of trouble.
This slow-growing localized prostate cancer sounds to me a lot like DCIS in women with breast cancer.
Well, it's equivalent in terms of its severity. And there we're looking at 2 or 3% of DCIS patients with breast cancer of dying. And the other 97 or 98% will die with it but not from it. And yet, once a woman knows that she has a DCIS cancer, it's like she really wants to do everything she can to take it out. And a lot of the time, what you can do is just follow it over time and see what it does, and then make the decision about what to do. And the outcome might be just about the same.
The problem is it really scares people, and they're afraid to just watch and wait because they're afraid that it's going to kill them. But if you look at these statistics and know that it only kills 3% and 97% don't need the treatment.
Yeah, well, here's the problem. Of the 17% of men who were eventually diagnosed with prostate cancer, the risk of dying is only about 3%, as we've been saying. But what you find is that the incidence of urinary incontinence is about 17% in people who have undergone surgery and only about 6% in the observation group. And 81% of the surgery patients also had impotence, whereas only 44% in the observation group did. So what you've got here is an approach that's causing lots of side effects. So that's why people like Thomas Stamey and the United States Preventive Services Task Force and the Institute of Medicine are coming around saying we need a better test to screen for prostate cancer, and we don't have one. And in the meantime, we recommend only doing the PSA test on certain people who are particularly high risk.
Yeah, the medical organizations aren't even recommending testing for prostate
cancer.
Most
of them aren't, but some do.
I also think it's good for people to be aware that 50% of men at age 50 have prostate cancer.
The localized prostate cancer that only 2 or 3% will die from.
And also the same with 60 at age 60, 60% have it, 70% have it, and so on. And they are finding from autopsies, like you said, and so forth, that men are usually not dying from it, they die with it. So in other words, by the time they die, they've died from something else. They just, that they happen to find this in the autopsies.
So what's the bottom line here? Is we need a screening test that makes sense. One that's not invasive, that's safe to do, that's inexpensive, and can tell you what's going on in the prostate. Now, there is an MRI with spectroscopy for a mere $6,000. You can get it, and it will very accurately identify what's in the prostate.
Will insurance cover it?
Sometimes, but it's much less than you would like. And, of course, it's not practical because you have to follow this, too. And you're not going to do two or three MRIs with spectroscopy every, you know, at intervals of a year or two. So that, while it works, is not practical. Then we have something called a 3D, 4D color Doppler, which is a sonogram of the prostate that's done in a couple of places, but probably the most famous place is Robert Bard out of, I think he's at NYU. That test is about $800, a little bit more reasonable to do. And oftentimes in my patients who I suspect might have prostate cancer for one reason or another, I'll send them there if they can't afford to do the MRI with spectroscopy, because you really want to know what is this cancer doing before you get aggressive with it. So that could be done. But we need a test that's better yet, that's less expensive and readily available.
I think something that might be reassuring for people, too, and also acknowledge the power of prayer, maybe, is that some cancers they're finding just go away on their own.
Well, if you autopsy women who died at age 50 from other causes like auto accidents, and you section their breasts, you'll find that 30% of them have not DCIS, but invasive cancers. These are real cancers. But yet, in our clinical work, we don't find 30% of women with breast cancers. So what is obviously happening is that a lot of these breast cancers that are there are inert. They're not doing anything, and they're going away. So there's a spontaneous remission in that setting. We have the same thing probably with lung cancers and other cancers. And so the question comes up, how aggressive should we be with our screening? Do you want to know if you have a cancer?
Yeah, maybe it's better not to know.
Well, a lot of the time by that we pick it up, we're looking at stage 4 disease, meaning that it's outside the local area and it's metastasized to other areas of the body. Do you know what the benefit of finding that is? How well does chemotherapy work in stage 4 cancers? At 5 years, 2% in the United States are living 5 years. So we're looking at
a miserable life from the side effects as well.
So maybe it's better off not even knowing. And so that question comes to my mind a lot of the time when I'm dealing with somebody who I think might have cancer. And a lot of the time in my patients that are over 80, if their health is excellent, I might be a little aggressive with the workup, but if they're over 80, they don't have great health, I'm inclined not to do the test to diagnose the cancer unless there's something that is important to do that could change it. So, for example, if somebody had a colon cancer and I was suspicious of that, well, you wouldn't want to die of obstruction. You know, if you block the colon,
that's pretty miserable.
It's a miserable death. And so, yes, it would be good to know that. But what if somebody had symptoms that could be consistent with a pancreatic cancer? Would you want to diagnose that? Well, you'd want to make sure they didn't have another cause for it, so it gets complicated. But there comes a time in the workup where the doctor kind of knows what's going on, and if you tell that person they have cancer, you're going to elicit that nocebo effect. You have cancer. It's bad. You will die prematurely from it, even if you're old. And I don't want to do that. So it becomes an interesting philosophical argument. It becomes a medical legal issue. Because if you don't do the workups that are recommended by the medical community where you live, you're talking about malpractice and lawsuits and people knowing that you've been negligent, if you want to call it that, which I don't think it is.
And then on the other hand, if somebody had like a little cancer that was localized, it was just starting like in the breast, mm-hmm. you could do a lumpectomy, and sometimes that's enough to just stop it right there in its tracks.
It is. I can think of a person who was in her late 60s. She had a 1 centimeter breast cancer that was found on a mammogram. And she says, I don't want to do anything about this because I think it's not going to be a problem. And I begged her. I said, why don't you just have it out? Just take it out and you won't have to worry about it. She said, no, I have great confidence, so I'm just going to do my own thing. Well, she lived another 6 or 7 years, but it was a localized cancer that probably 75 or 80 or 90% of the time would have been resolved by a surgery. So the art of medicine comes into play here, and it's a huge thing to be able to know when to do what, and it's not always what the standard of practice calls for. So it becomes very interesting to try to be a real doctor and be with your patient and listen and care and support and try to go along with their thinking as much as you can, keeping in mind that your fund of knowledge presumably is much better than theirs.
And realizing to not treat all patients the same, that everybody's an individual.
That uniqueness is what we forget about, and that's what HMO medicine has led to. So we wind up with a kind of health care that's academic, impersonal, not well grounded in science. That's the real shame of it, and that's why we were talking earlier about the FDA and the European agencies that regulate drugs to make these studies available so we can see them and they can be researched and double checked and to make sure that funny things didn't happen, that numbers weren't changed. You need to look at the raw data, and there are people that would like to do that because we know that we can't trust what's happening. So when we're looking at cancers, we have to look at the people who have them and then make decisions about what next steps are.
What's best for them? What can their families live with, too? You know, many times you're dealing with the patient's families.
Sure. You're also looking at tremendous costs sometimes. It's not unusual to spend $100,000 a year for chemotherapy drugs. And you'd think, that's just unbelievable that you could spend that much money, but you sure as heck can. And do we really want to be spending all the money we're spending on people who are at the end of life rather than doing wellness and prevention and natural therapies and trying to make the health of this country better? I can't see spending 50% of our dollars in the last year of life. I can see spending them in the first years of life, and I can see education being important. You want real health care reform? Then you better do something to reform the way we're looking at the practice of medicine.
And it starts with you. Everybody needs to take responsibility for their own health.
Well, for sure that. But we need to be educating people at every level. We need to be looking at how do we get people to eat right and to get enough sleep, and how do we reduce their stress? How do we make them get enough exercise and weigh what they should and have meaningful purpose in their life?
This is why we do this show.
Well, that's right. And of course, if we all did that, our health care costs would go down immensely. We'd be looking at 80 to 90% less dollars spent in health care. That money could be used in many other ways to help us with our lives, to make them have values that are better. We need to do a lot of things that are simple, that don't cost a lot of money, that if we take personal responsibility for, we can put into action.
Knowledge is power, and awareness and education are the first step to change. And so whatever you learn about being healthy, you can spread that word and let your family and your friends know about it.
Well, wouldn't it be nice if we had a healthcare system from the work from the top down, from the highest level of government first, where the Congress of the United States found a way to try and give us wellness and prevention and made health care available for everybody so it was universal, not just a few little things that happened with the Affordable Care Act. We have lots of things that we need to change, and when we change them, we'll have a health care system that is truly reformed. Well, we're at the end of the show again. I'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk live about what's new in the news and health and take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 1 to 2 Eastern Time and 10 to 11 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be archived on drsaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you've enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, you can go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com. And check out our fast track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a wonderful week, and we'll be back talking to you next Monday.